So tonight I want to talk about one of my absolute favorite pieces of the Sutta. I call this talk Cross the Flood. And it's based on a verse from the Majjhima Nikaya. This is in Sutta 22, verse 13, for those of you who are taking notes. Because I will show you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, venerable sir, the bhikkhus replied. The bhikkhus all reply, yes, sir, so very obedient. Bhikkhus, suppose a man in the course of a journey saw a great expanse of water, whose near shore was dangerous and fearful, and its further shore was safe and free from fear, but there was no ferry boat or bridge for going to the far shore. Then he thought, this is a great expanse of water, whose near shore is dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore is safe and free from fear, but there is no ferry boat or bridge for going to the far shore. Suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and bind them together into a raft, and supported by the raft, and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. And then the man collected grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and bound them together into a raft, and supported by the raft, and making an effort with his hands and feet, he got safely across to the far shore. Then, when he had got across and had arrived at the far shore, he might think thus, this raft has been very helpful to me. Since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to hoist it on my head or load it on my shoulder and then go wherever I want. Now, bhikkhus, what do you think? By doing so, would that man be doing what should be done with the raft? No, venerable sir. By doing what? By what, doing what would that man be doing? What should be done with that raft? Here, bhikkhus, when the man has got across and has arrived on the far shore, he must think thus, this raft has been very helpful to me, supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to haul it onto the dry land or set it adrift in the water and then go wherever I want. Now, bhikkhus, it is by doing so that the man would be doing what should be done with the raft. It's a really interesting story. And basically what it is, this is a really long extended metaphor. And so what I want to do for the rest of this talk is sort of take this metaphor apart piece by piece and see what the Buddha is actually saying here. First of all, so here's the image of the man. He's on a journey and he comes to this body of water. In other suttas, and I'll get to them eventually, sometimes body water is called the flood. So the image is like the flood of stuff that flows, the flood of experience we're all in the midst of all the time. But we're right now, if we're on the new shore, as it's said, and this is like where things are difficult and dangerous. And it isn't, I want to start by making sure you understand, it isn't the world that is dangerous. It's our habitual reactive patterns of mind, our tendencies towards greed, aversion, and delusion. That's what makes it dangerous. Okay? And the safe shore is a place where we've learned equanimity. We've learned not to be reactive. So this is right understanding. The first step in the Eightfold Path is we understand that's the direction we have to go in. We have to go from the danger shore to the far shore. So, what arises in our external world and in our internal world, our minds, seem totally overwhelming. It's that flood of stuff. It's just like never ends. There's this and there's that and there's this and there's that. Continuous flow of thoughts and experiences, caught in memories and regrets, past and thoughts of worry about the future. That's the flood caught in. But how can we break down the flood a little more? There's a teacher called Ajahn Susito, and he has broken the flood down into four pieces, which I think is quite a useful way to think about it. The first of these is what he calls the flood of sensuality. This is like sense experiences that we label pleasant and unpleasant and go after and try to avoid. So we react. That's our traditional way. It's pleasant, want more. Unpleasant, push it away. This is what Ajahn Susito has to say here. This is from his book called Parami. With some experience and considered attention, we can note that none of these, once seen, heard, etc., actually induce the kind of feeling that the current promises in any but the most fleeting way. In the gentle or pulsing waves of the flood, however, the objects of the senses seem irresistible, charming, and productive of real satisfaction. It happens all day long, and with luck, sometimes it's mostly okay. Sometimes it's pleasant for a short while, and sometimes it's unpleasant. But the pleasant, once established, gets to be normal and then boring, so the desire for newer sources of pleasure kicks in. However, we can't really have any of it because it runs through consciousness like water through our fists. Sensory input with its pleasures and displeasure passes. So this is the first layer of the flood. And the thing he's making here, I think the image of it passes through our hands like water through our hands. It's like, yes, all those things are pleasant, and we can't deny that, and we should certainly enjoy them. But they're not the solution at all. They just pass on by. Okay. So then the next one he calls flood of becoming. The idea that centers around time and identity. Thoughts of past and future are actually happening right now. This is a really interesting thing he says here. And yet there's a current in the mind that creates a felt identity who was, is, will be. This is what we do. We have this idea that we're permanent now, right? Rolling on its surface are worries and expectations about what I will be, nostalgia and regret for about what I was. A conceit may form, having been this, surely I deserve to become that. Or its negative form, I've never been this, so I'll never come one of those. There's a lot of drama and suffering and stress in this flood. So much that we will fail to question, who is this character? We don't question the I. It's just, well, of course, right? The spell of the flood of becoming doesn't work in the present. That's why we study it, because through investigation, we come out of it. So this part of the flood is this idea of things in the past are real, things that are things that we think are going to happen in the future are real. At a certain point, we go, no. Those are just thoughts in the mind. That's all they ever are. There's no solidity to them, except the solidity that we give them by identifying with them, and they become our self, if we're not careful. Okay. And then the third layer that Ajahn Sethi talks about is the flood of views, which is basically an extension of the flood of becoming. Deep-rooted ideas of who we are and how things are. And I've talked about view and the danger of view in many other talks lately, so I won't say more than that. But remember, this is where we catch ourselves over and over again saying in our minds, well, of course it's that way, or it's always been that way, or well, of course that's the way it should be. Because it's our views support that idea of how things are or how they should be. But views are just more subtle thoughts, the more just more subtle arisings in the mind. And sure enough, we cling to them because we create this sense of identity around I'm the person who believes this and doesn't believe that, and I'm against those people who believe that because I believe this, and all of that energy we put into these things around views is just so deeply embedded in how we think of ourselves. And finally, Ajahn Sucita talks about the flood of ignorance, which is not seeing things as they really are. You know, as they really are, things are impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self. This is sort of the underground current supporting the other three. This is what lies underneath everything. Every experience we're having is impermanent. Everything arises, it's there for a while, and it's gone. But we don't see that. We get so fixated on what's actually the actual event itself that we don't see its nature. But the nature of everything is they're impermanent, they're unsatisfactory, they don't bring us to any complete happiness. And that's true because we keep identifying with them as part of who we are, as self, instead of seeing that not self is the actual truth. So that's what the flood is like. And the problem is, we somehow keep believing as we come to that shore and we look all across this huge expanse of, oh my God, look at all that. It's a wide flood. That I'm not ready. I'm not ready to go across. I need to be better. I need to be more whole. I need to have more time before I try to cross over. Now, I'm not ready to do this. This is what we believe over and over and over again. We get to that shore, and then we go, oh no, I just have to stay on this dangerous shore because there's no way I'm gonna get across. And we need to form, once we have right understanding, which is we understand this flood somewhat, as Ajahn Sucita has pointed it out, then we have to form right intention, which is basically, I gotta get across. Basically, that's what right intention, like I'm gonna go across this flood. I'm gonna get to the other side of this body of water. I wanna get to that safe shore on the other side. But there's no ferry and there's no bridge. There's no easy way, right? A ferry or a bridge, I could just get on the ferry and that'd be on the other side, or a bridge, I could just walk across. Wouldn't that be great? No effort involved, hardly. But this doesn't work that way, right? We have to do this on our own. We can't depend on anything other than ourselves. And there's no way to make it easy and no way to avoid the struggle. We can't avoid it. So, as he says, oh, here I am. I think I'd better make a raft. You know, I can use a raft to get across to the other side. But then we think, oh, yeah, okay, I could see that. I need to get across to the other side. So I'm going to build myself the best darn raft you ever saw. You know, I'm going to go chop down some trees and get some really good logs and make it the good kind of wood that floats really well. I'm going to bind them all together and I'm going to build a little hut on the raft to keep all my stuff in. And then I'm going to, you know, make a mast and a sail so that, you know, when the wind's just right, I can just sort of float across to the other side. So we keep thinking somehow, I got to figure out a way to make it easy to get across. There's got to be some easy way. But that's not what Buddha is saying in the sutta. He's saying, basically, you're ready to do this right now. You don't need anything special. You don't have to make giant preparations and plans and schemes that make it the right way. All we have to do is go to the other side. And then he says he says this wonderful thing. He says, I think this is, suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches, and leaves and bind them together into a raft. So let's just look around. What do I got right at hand, right here? Just a bunch of grass, twigs, and things. And I'll bind it all together, and that'll be my raft. You don't need to do anything special. You don't need to make a big production out of making this raft. You just make a raft out of whatever's at hand right now. Whatever's going on in your life right now, that's enough. You can get across to the other side. It's because I need to. And I can take whatever I have right now. But, you know, the hard part. Oh, think about this. It's just a bunch of twigs and grass and leaves and a few branches bound together. And then you're going to put this out in this body of water. And using your arms and your legs, you're going to sort of kick and pull yourself across. In other words, you're going to get really wet. You can't avoid getting really wet. You can't avoid the unpleasantness of this process at all. It's going to be really wet and messy. That's just the way it is. You can't avoid the flood. You can't, you know, Dana Falls in one of her poems talks about pole vaulting over suffering. You can't pole vault over the flood. You've got to get right down in it and splash around, and gradually using arms and legs, using your own, just you, no one's helping you, you're going to get across to the other side. And so what is this raft, this the image, raft image? That rivage is the Dhamma. You know, the Dhamma is the creates a raft for us. It allows us to by just looking at it and fitting it together, the parts of it that make work for us and how we relate to it, and use that, that's going to get us across to the other side. That's what the Dhamma is. It's a raft to take us to the other side. I want to read a couple of other things here. This is a poem by Dana Falls. And she points out to the nature of this splashing process, in a way. Awakening, can I withstand the radiance? When the goddess gazes from my eyes, when my heart opens wide, when the current of life sweeps me away from safety, when even the illusion of control is lost, and I have what is lost, and what's left to me is love, can I breathe a prayer of gratitude and praise? Unlike the winter groundhog, can I raise my face to the sun and not run from the shadow that embodied I will always cast in daylight? This is that shadow side is what's saying, no, no, I'm not ready. No, no, I'm not perfect. I'm not good enough yet. I'm not perfect enough. And she's saying, the shadow comes with us. Right into the water, guaranteed. We can't ignore it because it's part of us, but it isn't, we can't let it stop. And there's another famous piece of Dhamma. This is from a lesser known Dhamma book. It's called The Velveteen Rabbit. And it's actually, this is a wonderful children's tale that is just pure Dhamma. This is partway through the story. What is real? Asked the rabbit one day. Does it mean having things that buzz inside and a stick out handle? Real isn't how you are made, said the skin horse. It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just play with, but really loves you, then you become real. Does it hurt? Sometimes, for he was always truthful, when you are real, you don't mind being hurt. Does it happen all at once, like being wound up, or bit by bit? It doesn't happen all at once. You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't often happen to people who break easily or who have sharp edges or have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off and your eyes drop out and you get loose in the joints and very shabby. But these things don't matter at all, because once you are real, you can't be ugly, except to people who don't understand. I suppose you are real. And then he wished he had not said it, for he thought the skin horse might be sensitive. But the skin horse only smiled. The boy's uncle made me real. That was a great many years ago. But once you are real, you can't become unreal again. It lasts for always. The rabbit sighed. He thought it would be a long time before his magic, called real, happened to him. He longed to become real, to know what it felt like, and yet the idea of growing shabby and losing his eyes and whiskers was rather sad. He wished that he could become it without these uncomfortable things happening to him. I love this because it's such pure Dhamma, and I must acknowledge this is David Chernikov turned me on to this a long time ago, and I happen to just love that bit of wisdom in this simple story. And he's pretty to exactly the same thing. We have to get out there and directly experience the contents of our mind. We have to accept that we have a shadow side, the dark side. It's just like that's we're human beings. You know, and we can't sail over our thoughts. We have to get round in the flood and use our arms and legs and paddle across, as scary as it might seem. That's just the nature of this process. It's going to be difficult and it's going to be scary and we're going to get really wet. It's just the nature of practice. But it sounds kind of discouraging, doesn't it? But here's another piece of sutta. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya, which is the collected discourses. And the first chapter in the Samyutta Nikaya is a collection of times when various devas and higher beings came to the Buddha for instruction. And this is one of those occasions. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savatthi in Jetha's grove. Then, when the night had advanced, a certain deva of stunning beauty, illuminating the entire Jetha's grove, approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, stood to one side, and said to him, "How, dear sir, did you cross the flood?" "By not halting, friend, and by not straining, I crossed the flood." "But how is it, dear sir, that by not halting and not straining you crossed the flood?" "When I came to a standstill, friend, then I sank. But when I struggled, then I got swept away. Isn't this, friend, that by not halting but by not straining, I crossed the flood?" This is a teaching on the middle way. But as part of this metaphor, it's kind of interesting. Then, you know, we have to have this balanced effort. You know, if we're going to cross the flood, we can't pause and just sort of hang out, but we can't overstrive. We need this sort of balanced approach. You know, this is right action and skillful effort, you know, the steps on the Eightfold Path. If we strain, if we try too hard, make the practice a grim sort of duty, like, "Oh, I have to practice today because I'm supposed to," and blah, blah, blah. Then we're swept away because we become exhausted or discouraged. When we strain, we get even wetter. It gets really splashy. We become overwhelmed by our thoughts and emotions. It just becomes too much. But if we halt, we sink. We get swallowed up by the constant stream of thoughts and emotions. We lose the strength of practice that we have gained. We'll have to start all over again. This is why daily practice is so strongly emphasized and why continuity of practice is emphasized on retreat. Often this sort of energy arises, like we get to a certain point in the practice and we're sort of like, ah, I got this now. I've got this figured out. Yep, sure enough. And people sort of slow down and stop practicing and stop paying attention because they've got it figured out, right? And often this will happen after someone has some really powerful, intense experience, because that it seems like, well, that's it. I've had that amazing experience. That's it. I'm done. But it doesn't work that way. And we can't fall into that place of, well, I'm just fine. I'm doing fine as I am right now. I don't need to keep diligently practicing. There's another understanding of this image as well, I think, that we can look at. We halt because we cling to the pleasant in our practice. Oh, this is so great. I'm having these really deep, concentrated sits, and I'm feeling this energy building in my body, and it's just really sweet. And we want to keep it. I want to keep that energy and experience. And the truth is, we'll keep it for a while, and it's going to go away. Because like everything else, it's something that arose and it's there for a while, and then it's gone. And it may never come back. And we have to go, oh, that's okay. Can, you know, follow that is like going to be some miserable, difficult time. Almost, gee, after that sweet stuff, you know, we got what they talk of 10,000 joys, 10,000 sorrows. Well, there we are in some of the 10,000 joys. Well, sure enough, we're going to get the balance. We're going to get some of the 10,000 sorrows. It's the way, the nature of this practice. We swing back and forth between those edges. And then we strain when we are averse to the unpleasant, which is the opposite. You know, we try too hard. Oh, this is pleasant, so I have to really work hard, and I'm going to get rid of these unpleasant things. And of course, that strain just makes it more unpleasant. And they get discouraged, like, oh, I keep working so hard, and then this horse stuff just keeps coming and coming, and then, you know, they sink. People sink. You know, these are both ways that people think sink. But there's an interesting corollary to this idea. What was being said here? This is the Buddha talking, right? And Buddha's saying, sometimes he sank. Sometimes he tried too hard, so he tried over and over again, and he kept sinking. Oh wait, so the Buddha sank. It sort of makes me, in an odd way, makes me go, oh, so that's like, if he kept sinking, well, what am I have to worry about? You know, it's like we caught on the edge of this and going, oh, you know, I'm gonna fail. And the fear of failure itself stops us from pushing any further. Somehow that fear that I'm not going to get across stops us. But the Buddha didn't get across a bunch of times. He kept failing and starting again. And this is that neat thing we have to keep remembering, is this practice, we have to just keep starting again and starting again. And every time we fail, we learn something. Sometimes there's a very unpleasant bit of learning, but we learn something, we tune into something, go, oh, yeah. And so the next time, there we are splashing around in the flood, we're more likely to sort of not do that again. Or if we again, at least we'll catch ourselves a bit. Oh, I've been here before. Oops, there we go. Sinking again, but now I caught it earlier at least. You know? And we over time we learn and learn. And it just it's like Buddha just openly admits, yeah, I failed. It has no sort of like sense of like, oh, I have to be perfect. I failed. Absolutely. Sure enough, I had tough times. And it sort of makes him more human and makes it more accessible to us other humans, I think. But the other interesting thing is that I have to get a book. I forgot. I thought I had all my books here. So just excuse me. Yeah. This book is called First Buddhist Women, and it's talking about getting to the other shore. This is like, these are people who were students of the Buddha and got to the other shore. And it's interesting, this book, because every time that these bhikkhunis, these nuns, had actually became enlightened, they would write a poem. It was a part of tradition. They'd write a poem that expressed how they did that. It was like in some simple poetic way. This is Uttama's story. 4 or 5 times I left my cell. I had no peace of mind, no control over my mind. I struggled and failed several times. I went to a nun I thought I could trust. She taught the Dhamma, the elements of body and mind, the nature of perception, and earth, fire, water, and wind, the four elements meditation. I heard what she said and sat cross-legged, 7 days full of joy. When on the eighth stretched my feet out, the great dark was torn apart. So she, what she's saying is, I kept struggling and failing, and then something this teacher said to me inspired me in such a way that I sat down for 7 days, a 7 day retreat, but didn't get up, a pretty serious retreat. And then she had this breakthrough into an enlightenment. And that's the nature of this practice too. At least that's so I've been told. I'm not now, no, I'm just, I'm not speaking from experience anymore here. This is what certainly there, you can read many stories like this. So this book, by the way, if you're interested, is called First Buddhist Women by Sun Murcutt, Murcott. And it's full of women and the stories of the women who's practiced with the Buddha. And I think it's useful to have this because much of the sutta is written in male language. And it's good to have the sense of that, you know, this was not just a male thing at all. This was very much, I mean, the Buddha was very open about taking women into the Sangha, and many of them became enlightened beings. But then that's okay. Now we've got across to the other shore. And then the Buddha says this really thing, interesting thing. He says, well, what do we do now with the raft? Remember, the raft is the teachings, the Dhamma, the practice. This raft has been very helpful to me. Since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to haul it onto dry land or set it adrift in the water, and then go wherever I want. Now, because it is by doing so that a man would be doing what should be done with the raft. So now he's saying, and I found this when I first read this, I was going, "What?" It was quite shocking to me. But he's saying, at a certain point, once you've become enlightened, you don't need the raft anymore. You can just leave it. You can instead of carrying, like I said, remember that before the guy was carrying it around on his shoulder or figuring out how to take it with him. And he's saying, at a certain point, even the Dhamma can't be clung to. I'm going, whoa. I remember the first time I thought this is something, even the teachings of the Buddha, even the Dhamma, even the practice isn't something to cling to. We start clinging to the teachings and then we get bogged down in clinging to them. It's just now we've got this really holy, perfect, beautiful thing, but we're clinging to it. It's just another form of clinging. But the tricky part, it's the number one, just accept, oh yeah, the Dhamma is just skillful means. That's all the Buddhist teachings are, just skillful means to get us to the other shore. Following the teachings of the Dhamma gets us to the other shore. But they're just skillful means. They're not holy scripture in that sense at all. They're not like, that's it, just keep doing this forever and you'll be okay. But the question then comes, well, how do I know? How do I know I've got to the other side? How do I know I'm on the other shore? How do I know I'm not just totally deluded in thinking I'm on the other shore? And that's a somewhat more difficult question. But I mean, this do it has a couple of really interesting allusions here. One of them, this is from the Samyutta Nikaya, and this is a classic Buddha example of something that we'd all understand because we're all experienced it in our lives. When Bhikkhu, a carpenter or a carpenter's apprentice, looks at the handle of his adze, he sees the impressions of his fingers and his thumb, but he does not know so much of the adze handle has been worn today, so much yesterday, so much earlier. But when it is worn away, the knowledge occurs to him that it is worn away. This, it's like at a certain point, you know. But all the rest of the time, you're just doing the work. You're swinging your adze and chopping away at things and working and working and working. And then at some point, you work a point where you've worn away the handle. Don't need it anymore. And then you'll know. And this is, I think for a lot of people, this is a difficult idea because it's like, what do you mean I'll know? Like, what is that? What does that even mean? You'll know. But that's the only way I've ever seen it explained. You can read all kinds of things that people, the experiences people had when they became enlightened. Like that thing I just read from Susan Murcott. But that was that person's experience, and yours is going to be more experience, whatever it is. It just, that's the way it is. It's like you can't explain it in any other way. And the answer, here's another interesting thing. There's this whole series of things in the story, people coming to the Buddha and saying, "Hey, we made it. We're enlightened now. We've crossed to the shore." And the Buddha quite vigorously questioned this. He didn't sort of take as like, well, they say it's so done. So this is from the Madhyama Nikaya 105. I heard, Venerable Sir, that a number of bhikkhus have declared final knowledge, the presence of the Blessed One. Did they do so rightly, or were some Bhikkhus here who dare find knowledge because they overestimate themselves. When those bhikkhus declared final knowledge in my presence, there are some bhikkhus who declared final knowledge rightly, and there are some who declared final knowledge because they overestimated themselves. Therein, when bhikkhus declare final knowledge, their declaration is true. But when bhikkhus declare final knowledge because they overestimate themselves, I think I should teach them the Dhamma. So we're saying, oh, these guys think they've made it, but they haven't. So I haven't done my job yet. I have to teach them more Dhamma. So the Buddha takes responsibility on himself for these people who are deluded. Interesting, I think. And then the rest of the sutta, he sort of goes through these sort of layers of how you might know that you're enlightened. And there's a case, it has a couple of images. Just as a yellow leaf that has fallen from its stalk is incapable of becoming green again, so too, when a person intent on the imperturbable has shed the fetter of worldly material things, he should be understood as a person detached from the fetter of worldly material things, who is intent upon the imperturbable. So this is one of the stages of enlightenment where you're no longer caught in what craving. You're not enlightened yet, but you're like a leaf that's fallen and will never be green again. It's like, I'm not going to get caught there anymore. And then he says, it's possible that some person may be completely intent on Nibbana. When a person is completely intent on Nibbana, only talking concerning that interests him, and his thinking and pondering are in line with that, and he associates with that kind of person, and he finds satisfaction in that. Just as a palm tree with its top cut off is incapable of growing again, so too, when a person is completely intent on Nibbana, his fetter of the base of neither perception nor non-perception has been cut off at the root. So this is, he's talking about the stage that people go through. He's saying that at a certain point, when your only focus, that the exception of everything else is understanding the truth, then sure enough, that's what's going to happen. And this sutta goes on for many, many verses talking about this stepwise sort of process. I think it's interesting, that particular teaching, because it points to something we often forget. This isn't like an on-off switch. It isn't like, oh, now you're on the other shore. It's like all the time we're going across through the flood. It's a little bit more enlightened, a little bit more enlightened, and a little moment of enlightenment, and a little more and more, more so enlightened. It's like a process. It's the process that's important, not the end point. The end point is going to take care of itself, and essentially, you know, at some point the ad's handle is going to wear away, right? The end point is going to take care of itself. What's important is that we keep have faith in the process. If we keep embedding ourselves in the process and practicing, and imperceptibly things shift over time. And this has certainly been my personal experience. I mean, look back on my many years of practice and where I started, and I don't want to sound like I'm anywhere special, but I've learned a few things along the way, and it's like I can see through my experience of my life in the moment that things have really changed in a wholesome, positive direction. And that's little moments of enlightenment tied together, leading to little bigger moments of enlightenment. But it's a process. It's not like anything other than that. It's just that we're moving in that direction. And this is happening to all of us right now. Right now, we're sharing the Dhamma. And in the process of sharing the Dhamma, These little seeds of enlightenment are planting, and some of them are even sprouting a little. That's what's happening right now. We can never forget that. It's like we're already in there splashing. You know, some of us might be sort of on the edge, sticking one foot in the water, but we're all in there. And some of us are out in the middle of the stream, about to go down yet again, probably. But that's what's going on all the time. That's what this practice does. And so all it does is we have to decide, I'm going to do this. And we have to sort of choose to get wet. We have to take the resolve and go out there and get wet. That's the only choice we have. That's what we have to do. And of course, I have a little bit more poetry to talk about this. This is Dana Falls again. Called Life Here at the Edge. When love lights a fire in the heart, don't be so quick to quell the flames. You can be fully alive. To be fully alive is to welcome the beloved in countless names and guises, not turn away the wild with the tame. Drink your fill of longing. Let love wash through in waves that lift you up and carry both your daring and your fear straight to unknown places. Yes, there is danger in staying safely cloaked in morality and labels, but there is life here at the edge, and a choice to be made between thoughtful abandon and passionate restraint. The plaintive cry of the heart can be ignored only at the price of a fully realized life. Throw arms wide to possibilities that move and call you to come forth in freedom and in fullness. Trust the seed of grace within to blossom without sin or sorrow, for you are surely big enough to hold the truth as it unfolds. Those last two lines, for you are surely big enough to hold the truth as it unfolds. That's what we have to take in. That this is something we can all do, that we're all capable of going deeper into this practice and deeper into this practice and getting wetter and it being messy, but learning as we go along. That's what this practice requires. It doesn't work any other way. There's no magic solution. We just have to actually pay attention to what the practice says and then do it. This is what the Buddha taught. Take our raft, our version of that raft, and get out there. That's what we have to do. So that's all I have.